Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. A police officer in Lancaster shot and killed a man who was charging him with a knife Sunday afternoon. The family of the man who was killed, 27-year-old Ricardo Muñez, said he suffered from bipolar disorder and schizophrenia and had stopped taking his medications. Police were called to Muñez's mother's home after he was reported to be acting aggressively. After the shooting, protests began and some turned violent with vandalism and property damage. Police have reportedly made about a dozen arrests. Lancaster Mayor Deneen Sirachi called Sunday a heartbreaking day in Lancaster and called for help from the state and the county in dealing with access to mental health services and poverty. Mayor Sirachi joins us on this portion of today's Smart Talk. Mayor, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mayor Sirachi, how would you describe the last 4 days and maybe even right now in Lancaster?
But that's a hard question to answer because I think that as a community, there's a tremendous amount of grief and sadness because it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy for the Munoz family, and it is a tragedy for the police officer involved.
I'm going to talk about some of the things that you mentioned at your press conference on Monday in what you feel this city needs to prevent tragedies like this from occurring. But let's go back to Sunday. How did you learn of the shooting, and what were you told?
I learned of the shooting through social media. I happened to see a post, and I called our police chief and received confirmation that there was an officer-involved shooting and that it was a fatality.
So you actually learned about it on social media as well?
I did. It was only, like, in happenstance that happened that way. Typically, in these situations, obviously the police are responding to the scene and the chief is being notified as well on a Sunday afternoon. And then I am contacted as soon and as quickly as possible by a police chief in instances in which there is, public concern, and also this being the most most severe case and one that ended in tragedy.
Your police chief told Meredith Jorgensen of WGAL-TV, I saw the report last night, the interview that Meredith had done with him, that the police officer responded properly. Do you agree?
I am not going to comment one way or the other about how the police officer responded. This is an investigation about the appropriateness of use of force that is being taken up by the district attorney, Heather Adams, here in Lancaster County. And for me to comment would be inappropriate at this time.
So you're going to wait for the district attorney and the decision on what she makes?
I am, and there's a lot of information that I do not have access to and have not reviewed and would not be, I am awaiting the expert opinions of our district attorney's office. And as I said, there's a lot of information related to this case that I do not have access to.
In your mind, how did the protest come about? And how did they turn violent with fires and vandalism and some property damage?
Well, I think, Scott, if anybody's paying any attention, I mean, this has been a summer of a lot of pain and reflection related to our community and police relationships across the United States. And it is of no surprise to me that there were demonstrations and protests following police-involved shooting. I think that what was very, very troubling about the events of Sunday evening into early Monday morning was the degree of misinformation that was being promulgated through social media that, in my mind, acted as an accelerant to really attracting folks to the community, to downtown, that were not interested in a peaceful demonstration or protest. I also understand that, you know, I spoke to somebody yesterday and they're just like, like something's got to give. And I think, and just this moment in time, there is this overwhelming feeling about something's got to give. I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic. We are seeing nationwide protests larger than anything we've ever seen. We're seeing a large measure of distrust in government. And, you know, we're in a very politically divisive national moment related to the November 3rd election. It is, it has all of the things in my mind that make it a very tenuous situation for communities across the country. And I am not alone as a mayor who is working very hard to address the concerns from the community while also ensuring the safety of the community. And that conversation is an important one that must continue, and it is why I asked for help in addressing mental health services. And the way that I think about this, Scott, is very much, you know, there is a parable, a story about, you know, picking up starfish out of the sea, or, you know, pulling people out of the river without going upstream to understand why they're falling in the river. And I think about that because, you know, we have situations and that escalate to such a point that police are responding when situations related to mental health or domestic violence or so on that are very volatile. There's a lot of complexity. There's a lot of uncertainty. And while I understand and appreciate that our police have that job, we need to help them because they are responding to calls for service and being asked to do a job in which they're not getting any help at the beginning. And we need to help. We need to help the individual police departments across the Commonwealth and the individual officers and their families. We need to help our community. We need to help the families that live in our community, and we need to help the individuals who are dealing with mental health issues. This is just not working for anyone right now.
Now, what form would that take? I understand that the city of Lancaster and the police department have a social worker. In the second half of the program, and now we're going to be talking with someone from the Dauphin County program, about co-responders volatile situations. But you mentioned that Lancaster has a social worker. Does that social worker act as a co-responder? And then the second part of that question, what more does the city of Lancaster need?
So at this time, our social worker does not act as a co-responder to 911 calls that would happen on a Sunday afternoon. Now, our police officers provide referrals to our social worker for follow-up and to make sure that we're interceding in residents where there's multiple calls for service over time, or we're aware that from a neighbor or family member that this person needs assistance. That co-responder approach is not something that we have taken here, and part of that is, you know, again, sort of up the chain in terms of how we do 911 dispatch and what information we have and how that is being communicated when a call for service comes in. You know, we're receiving about 80,000 calls for service a year, and that's just in the city of Lancaster with 60,000 residents in a county with 550,000 people. And so that's a bigger question, and it's a question that I have in terms of what is the proper approach protocol? What is the solution here? And that will help guide the conversation about what more is needed. But right now, I will tell you that, you know, I am not a mental health professional. I am not in law enforcement. I am a mayor who is trying to respond to this community and our community's needs, our residents' needs, to have access to mental health and for that access to be more coordinated, unified. I'm not sure what the word is, but to have a more robust approach. And I think that Lancaster is not the only one that needs that. And I've been hearing really heartfelt concerns from other residents about their own experiences with a loved one with mental health, as well as outreach from other professionals who want to help, want to be engaged, want to figure this out. And I know we can't do it on our own.
Ricardo Munoz's family said on Sunday they were trying to have him involuntarily committed for treatment. And you just raised the point. I'll ask the question, but I think I know your answer. Did the police officer on Sunday know going in that there was a mental health crisis on Mr. Munoz's part? And are you saying that with these improvements that you're suggesting or asking for, that police may handle situations differently if they have this information ahead of time?
I don't know the nature of the 911 dispatch, and I can't really comment on the details related to Sunday afternoon because I do not have all of that information, and that information is being gathered and provided to the district attorney's office for review. What I can say is that it is clear to me that there is a need to do better, and I am committed to figuring out what that looks like for the benefit of our entire community.
You cited several other factors on Monday that a good portion of Lancaster's population living below the poverty level, education inequity, low-paying jobs. What roles do these play in police shootings, mental health, all the things that, I mean, that it kind of culminated in Sunday? It seems as though some frustration had built up in your mind, and it kind of culminated in Sunday.
So here's what I'll say about that. If we know that a third of the jobs in our region are low-quality jobs, meaning that they're seasonal, they have low pay, they're not providing benefits, then exactly how does one access and pay for mental health care when it's needed? And if there are public resources that are available, how are those resources being coordinated? And are they significant enough to meet the needs in our community? I don't know the answer to that question. What I do know is what it means to live in poverty and to not have access to basic health care, including mental health care. And this is something that I am very passionate about, and elevating the as a priority for us as a community, that if we care about our neighbors, if we are in fact committed to eradicating poverty, then we also must be honest about the effects of poverty in our community that go beyond individual families. And individual families, that should be enough. It should be enough that we're concerned about individual families. But I am looking at this in terms of if a third of our community is living below poverty, and, you know, if you look at some of the other data, there's another larger percent taken together that, you know, is on the edge of living in poverty. And now we're in a pandemic where the folks in the lowest quality jobs are the most affected by unemployment right now. It is highly tenuous, and we have to be talking about these issues in a more holistic manner. And that is what I am really focused on.
Mayor, you know the reality, and you just mentioned that being in the middle of a pandemic, what you're suggesting, and I'm not suggesting that it can't be done, but what I just want to point out, and I'm sure this question is one of the first ones that you get all the time, is that the state is looking at a $5 billion budget deficit. Where does the money come from to do some of the things that you're talking about?
So I hear that, and, you know, I'm the mayor of a city with the highest municipal tax rate in our county and the highest concentration of poverty and 30% of our properties that are tax exempt. So I totally get it in terms of where's the money going to come from. And I understand certainly that we as a country are reeling under the economic fallout from COVID. What I'm suggesting is that we need to start having a conversation and developing a plan and approach, and we can get to the conversations about money, but we also need to understand that there are costs involved whether we do something or don't do something. And I would say that the human costs of that are significant and cannot continue to be under-resourced or, worse, ignored.
Let's take a phone call from Ellen in Lancaster. Ellen, you're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay, cool. I didn't know how this worked. My comment is that I live around the corner, and when I heard about the rioting, my family and I chose to leave town because we did not feel safe. And as much as I want to support improved mental health earlier in the pipeline of a crisis, I also want to support our police officers for protecting us.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your call. Mayor, your response to that?
I agree. I mean, we are all in this together, and I understand the tensions that exist between community and police. And I also understand that we've been addressing a number of issues from the community under the leadership of Chief Burkeiser, and those efforts are not going to be discontinued. And there is support for police in our community. People recognize in our neighborhoods the need for policing. And I think that, and we also are having a conversation about how we can do police better and different. And those two things can exist in the same sentence, and they can exist in our same, in our actions.
Mayor, I don't know. It sounds to me like you have to walk a fine line between supporting your police, but at the same time, listening to what the protesters have to say. Do you see it that way?
I see it in terms of what my job is, which is to be a steward to the public and the services that we provide in the city of Lancaster. And as mayor, I mean, we've been very focused on a continuous improvement across all of our departments as it relates to how we serve and the public. And I don't see those things as being in opposition? Are the conversations related to policing and community more challenging? Absolutely. They are caught up into a history of policing in our country. They are very much part of the difficult conversations that we must continue to have about racism in our country. So, yes. And this is why I have committed to, you know, a larger, broader focus related to racial equity as it relates to the service delivery in the city of Lancaster. And government alone is not going to solve this problem.
We have an email here from Thomas who says, I'm a property owner of multiple properties in the city. I spend time in the city and all the neighborhoods. All I see is disrespect for the city, trash thrown in the streets, weeds in the curbs, loud music, no respect for neighbors or self. Why is it that the city, instead of thinking about bars, galleries, and ball fields, why not try to get family-sustaining jobs to relocate here? All we build is high-end apartments, shopping centers, and restaurants. No one can make a living off that. Your response to that?
I don't disagree that we need more family-sustaining jobs, and that is why this must be a partnership between the business community and our communities. And I would say that if he would like to call my office with specific areas of concern related to trash, weeds, et cetera, we will follow up in kind. I also will say that our Office of Neighborhood Engagement and our neighborhood leaders continue to work to address quality of life issues throughout our neighborhoods. And at the end of the day, I think what the point of the email is poverty and lack of access to one good job. And I'm clear about that. And if the gentleman who wrote that email has specific suggestions about other things that we can be doing to advance that work, I'm all ears.
Mayor, one final question. You said we need to start the conversation, money aside. How does that conversation start?
Well, it's been really interesting. I have been getting emails and phone calls from folks who want to help. And so I have a list of names that have been put forward or other folks to reach out to as suggested contacts. And I'm going to be turning to, I don't know exactly how this is going to play out, but some kind of organizational lead that can help situate this conversation in the mental health arena, because this is an area of expertise that we don't have, while also obviously there will be a component of this that will be related to police response, but again, there needs to be a larger conversation. The police alone cannot solve this.
Lancaster Mayor Deneen Sirachi. Mayor Sirachi, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Pennsylvania possibly being part of a regional greenhouse gas initiative. A lot going on this week regarding what is referred to as REGGIE. That is coming up on tomorrow's program. Those who have suffered from mental illness may be going through a crisis and find themselves coming into contact with a police officer. We're often treated like any other person breaking the law or endangering themselves or someone else in the past. Well, it still happens often today, but more police departments and criminal justice agencies are trying to find ways to de-escalate what could be volatile situations with those suffering from mental illness. Dauphin County has enacted what it calls its Stepping Up Initiative. Joining us to talk about that is Catherine Kilgore, Dauphin County District Attorney's Office Criminal Justice Advisory Board Administrator. Ms. Kilgore, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing well. Also joining us, Elizabeth Manning and Devin Lever, both co-responders with police, and we'll talk about what a co-responder is and does in just a moment. Welcome to the show, both Ms. Manning and Lever.
Thank you, Scott. Good morning.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Catherine Kilgore, here's the broad question. What is the Stepping Up Initiative?
Sure. The Stepping Up Initiative was spearheaded in our county around the fall of 2016. Essentially, it's a system-wide, a criminal justice system-wide look at how an individual that has a severe mental health diagnosis, schizophrenia, major depressive disorders, those types of diagnoses, how that person, the case, how it flows through the system from the point of contact with police all the way through the point where a person might be on community supervision. There are four key measures that the Stepping Up Initiative looks at. Those are making sure your county can reduce jail bookings in general. In other words, that front end of the system when someone may or may not be charged. Reducing jail length of stay. We know that individuals that have, in many localities and prisons, individuals that have a severe mental health diagnosis may spend twice as long in jail as those without. Another measure is a connection to treatment, ensuring individuals that have these diagnoses that come in contact with our system are connected to the appropriate services so they can receive care. And then the last measure is looking at recidivism, the likelihood that a person with these diagnoses will come back into our justice system after the cycle has kind of, you know, worked its way through. So Dauphin County in the fall of 2016 decided to say, okay, what is happening in our system to individuals with these diagnoses? How are they being affected? And what can we do about it? I think that's one of the most important pieces of this initiative. So our commissioners, our Criminal Justice Advisory Board, all of our human services, law enforcement, criminal justice, related agencies partnered together with a consultant, the Council of State Governments, and engaged in an in-depth look at our system. There was a deep data dive done looking at our jails, our jail, looking at how folks were passing through the system. And what we found was, indeed, in our county, individuals with these diagnoses were staying longer. Just in general, for people at that time, the report was issued in 2018, who had an SMI stayed an average of 98 days in DCP compared to 70 days for those who did not have an SMI. And even individuals who ultimately were released on bail ended up staying in DCP if they went twice as long, 32 days compared to 16 days if they did not have an SMI. So we wanted to turn this around. And the report that was issued, it is publicly available. You can ask, have your viewers send me a request, or you can post it. There were several recommendations, and one of those was the police co-responder. An important part of what we wanted to do in the long term was focus on the front end of the system. This idea of even pre-police contact, you know, working with the community, but then also making sure that our officers had additional training if they needed it in how to approach, how to discuss these situations with individuals, families with mental health diagnoses, and the appropriate supports we could provide police. So one of those ultimate outcomes was working to hire our police co-responders. And there were several other recommendations in that report.
Can we talk about those in just a moment, Catherine?
Absolutely.
Because what I wanted, one of the things that it would seem to me, and you tell me, that the most volatile time is when the police officer first comes into contact with someone who may be suffering a mental health crisis, and may not know that this person is suffering from a mental illness, may not know that this person is crisis. So at that moment, what does this program do? Now, we're going to talk with the co-responders in just a moment, but how that would seem to be one of the biggest challenges is how to identify and de-escalate these situations when someone is going through a mental health crisis.
Well, and some of that comes down, some of that comes to training. In the crisis intervention training, one of the foundational pieces of what ultimately comes into a co-responder program is helping officers learn things they can look for in a situation that might indicate this person may have a mental health diagnosis, maybe in mental health distress. I think one of the challenges in the moment is that things can change very rapidly, and training is a critical foundational point of how individuals engage, officers engage. That's very important. They do receive, I think, good training. We can always be doing more, and I think the crisis intervention training that we provide is absolutely part of that. Dr. Yinger, who was hired to carry out the goals in our Stepping Up initiative, created a great curriculum. It's based off the Memphis model. It's a 40-hour training. So there are verbal de-escalation techniques. There are body language ways you can approach. And engaging the person and observing the environment in that moment can be critical. Things can change rapidly, but the co-responders are they have more of a social work background. They are individuals who have maybe training in case management or more extensive background in working with populations with mental health and even substance use disorder kind of needs. So they can help observe what's going on in the moment and help the officers even de-escalate some of the situations.
So let's talk.
Sure.
Go ahead. No, what are you going to say? No,
I think it's important to note that no one approach is 100% a silver bullet. There is no one approach that's going to solve what can emerge and can be a volatile situation. However, we can arm ourselves with this training, with opportunities and individuals who can focus in on slight maybe differences in behavior and do the best we can to keep everyone safe when police are called to respond to situations where maybe not all the information is known right away.
Devin Lever, you are a co-responder for, is it three or four townships in Dauphin County?
It's three of the townships.
Three of the townships? Okay, so talk about what Catherine Kilgore was just describing. And as I suggested, that first contact between a police officer and someone who may be suffering a mental health crisis, as a co-responder, first of all, what do you do? And how do you de-escalate the situation?
The first thing that I do when I'm with any of my three departments is when we get a call for anything for mental health related through dispatch, I automatically look up the name of that individual in the system to see what prior contacts there would have been. That way we can know what history, if any, has been developed already and see the outcomes of those calls from the past. Then also depending on what officer I'm with, because out of the three departments I'm with, a large majority of the officers have the CIT training. So with them having the CIT training, then they're also able to give feedback on what they feel, if they've worked with this individual before, how the outcomes work for them. And then we go in together as a team. We approach it very calmly, respectfully. We introduce ourselves. I introduce myself. I let that person know I'm not an officer. I explain my position. And then we talk. We talk through it. We listen to them. We hear their frustrations, their concerns. And this is if they're in a calm state. Now, if it's something where somebody is more worked up, we have to be more careful, but we still go in calmly, we go in respectfully, and we just try to listen and talk as much as we can to the person and work through. A lot of the times, too, when I'm talking with the individual, my officer will then step over if there's a family member there or an individual with them, talk to them, ask them for background. What happened? What caused the trigger to occur today? Is this common behavior for them? How long has this episode been going on for? And then we come back together. We make sure the person's calm now, they're safe, and then we talk. We figure out an outcome for them and what we want to do moving forward.
Elizabeth Manning, you are the co-responder for the city of Harrisburg. Just what Devin described, you know, sounds good. And I won't say in a perfect world, because it is not a perfect situation. But in those situations where, and I'll go back to what Mayor Sirachi had said earlier, she suggested that there has to be better information. She doesn't know, like with this incident that occurred in Lancaster on Sunday, what kind of information was passed along from the dispatcher. What if you, as a co-responder, don't have information on the mental state of the person that the police officer is dealing with. How do you get that?
So that can, it can go a different, a couple different ways on how we try to obtain the information. Generally in Harrisburg, when we're responding to a situation, there's at least two officers and myself, which is a great thing to have, because then we kind of, one of us is with the individual trying to get the information, or if it's me, it's myself and an officer close by, while the other officer is asking any relatives, friends, anybody on scene about what happened and the behaviors that led up to it and anything that they heard the person say or saw them do, in like any of the community members that were standing by, that we can get as much information as we can about the behaviors that were occurring while I am trying to talk to the individual to see what information that I can get out of them. And that can go a different, couple different ways. I'll straight up ask them if they have mental, if they had any mental health background. If they say no, I'll usually end up asking something about medications, and then that can help us lead, and we just ask questions that lead to the answers that we're trying to see, what kind of mental health diagnosis we are interacting with, and then help the person from there.
We're going to take a phone call in just a moment about dispatchers, because, again, that was something that Mayor Sirachi had mentioned, not knowing what information the dispatcher had relayed to this on this case on Sunday. But I want to find out what your experiences are. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Starting next week, Smart Talk will be interviewing candidates running for the U.S. House of Representatives and the statewide offices in Pennsylvania. That starts next Monday on Smart Talk, so be sure to tune in. Our guest during this portion of the program is Catherine Kilgore. She's the Criminal Justice Advisory Board Administrator with the Dauphin County District Attorney's Office. Elizabeth Manning and Devin Lever are both co-responders with police in when there are situations where mental health may be an issue. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Elizabeth in Mannheim. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Thank you. It seems to me that the emphasis on training has been for the police officers, and it's not starting early enough. It is important to train the dispatchers so that they get the information necessary to pass on to the police officers, so that police officers, where there is no social worker who can go out with them, will have the necessary information and can utilize whatever training they may be given. And so that where there is a social worker who can go with them, that it is known and that that person can be dispatched with the officer.
Catherine Kilgore, what about that? Thank you for your call, by the way, Elizabeth. Catherine, you know, and I think that's a point that I was trying to make earlier, that the mayor was trying to make, that dispatchers were somehow the police officer responding or the social worker co-responder need as much information as possible. Is it on the dispatcher?
I think the situations emerge. I think that's a critical component, and dispatchers can be part of the CIT training, individuals that are eligible to attend. We cross-trained. We have probation officers, police officers, dispatchers, folks in the district attorney's office, case managers who come and do attend these trainings. Sometimes individuals will call in, and I can't, you know, speak necessarily for our EMS as an agency, but sometimes someone will call in and say, you know, there's a certain situation. And once police arrive on the scene, we find out it's a very different situation than what was reported. So sometimes at that initial call, not all of the information is given. Absolutely, there are techniques that folks can do to kind of engage the person in conversation, get as much information as possible to ensure the police have that and to ensure our co-responders can look up and understand kind of what is happening there. But that training is important, and there we support that for an individual who would want to go through that and be part of that crisis intervention training. When we looked at the co-responders, this idea as one of the potential solutions as part of stepping up, We went back and actually looked at the number of calls we received, and our Department of Public Safety does maintain some of this information. They go back, issue a report, and we look at the calls associated with mental health service needs. And we had to go back in 2018 was the report we used. And Harrisburg City alone in a year had over 1,300 calls for assistance that related to individuals that had a mental health need or support. Lower Paxton had 500, Sotera had almost 350, and Susquehanna had over 300 as well. So these may be identified in the moment, and some, you know, after the fact. So I believe that there's merit to that. Training is critical as early as possible for as many people as possible. We can't do this alone as a system. Community training, family awareness, this sort of thing all matters to help us in the field, to help the police in the field, and to help our co-responders.
We have an email from Lynn. Actually, Lynn Keltz says, there's no doubt that the state and federal government, society as a whole, need to increase commitment to mental health beyond simply talking about it. One crisis team in a smattering of counties is not enough. What do you say to that, Catherine?
So I think that speaks to, I know Dr. Yinger, just as an example, she's been engaged with folks at the state level. I think Pennsylvania has taken a lead on this, and there can certainly be an exploration of different standards and different trainings that could be supported either at the state or local level. And I think that's part of the conversation we need to have in general, because if you go from one county to another county and the response may change, some of it has to do with resource. Every county in Pennsylvania is built differently. Every situation is different there, the locality, history. So training is one piece, absolutely. It starts with being able to have a conversation and talk about the different roles and responsibilities we have. So I do think there's absolutely an opportunity to work with state agencies, and we continue to, and in terms of the training police officers receive and other outreach that our system can do in general to engage individuals and be part of the solution.
I have heard people in the criminal justice system say many times that the situation we're in today as a society is that prisons, jails, have become the biggest places for treatment of mental health services in the country. There are percentages of people, a large percentage of people who are incarcerated who are suffering from a mental illness. Now, Catherine Kilgore, you said that the Stepping Up initiative is not just co-responders and dealing with this right up front. First of all, would you agree that many people who are incarcerated are suffering from a mental illness? And what is Dauphin County doing to try to get those people treatment?
I think there is a higher percentage of individuals with a behavioral health need, absolutely. I think data nationally and locally bears that out. In terms of whether that falls into that severe mental health diagnosis that I mentioned earlier, schizophrenia, major depressive disorder, we have at any given time at this point, we have about just over 100 individuals, I would say, from some of the recent data that have that diagnosis, and then other individuals that might have a substance use disorder or some other behavioral health. So we have any number of complex cases at the time. Our Human Services Behavioral Health Case Management Unit has been very actively engaged, along with our jail, in identifying individuals that have these diagnoses. So one piece that we've emphasized at the front end of the system is identifying an individual who does come through our system. So screening, a mental health screening, trying to be aware of someone who may need further assessment, be it for a substance use disorder or mental health or both. It's very common, unfortunately, to see this comorbidity, this co-occurring nature of these two, I hate to use the word maladies, but at booking, we wanted to do a better job of seeing that earlier. The officers and obviously our co-responders are a key part of that. They can identify that in the field, potentially de-escalate the situation. In the situations, though, where someone does need to be charged and that person is then coming to our booking center, we want to be able to do some formal screening, have a better idea of what assessment might be needed for that person, and then try to make that connection in the community to follow through on the treatment side. So we implemented these screenings, individual screenings at booking for both substance use disorder and mental health, and that has been ongoing, I believe, for more than a year at this point. And we have diversion specialists at the jail, Susan Irvin and her team. They do, I think, an outstanding job. If someone at booking, if the nature of the situation, the offense, may require or indicate the person has to go to jail for a period of time in that sort of pretrial status, we also have Team MISA. It stands for Mental Illness Substance Abuse. And we implemented this program. Lehigh County actually was the first county to do something like this, where they use information at the jail. The jail will do some further assessment screenings. Folks are identified who have these needs in more detail, take that information, and then are listed weekly. And there's a cross-representative, a collaborative team that will review the cases and try to ensure that person receives case management or case planning, and to see if we can expedite release, if that's an appropriate option. And that's done in conjunction with our district attorney's office as well as public defenders and folks throughout the system, human services. They'll look to see any case connection and case management they can make. And so that has been, I think, a hugely effective way, these abilities to identify folks earlier, get them planned onto Team MISA. And if, say, the person can't, for whatever reason, be planned through Team MISA, if they're still identified, we can expedite them through the system and try to get the resolution as quickly as possible. On the back end, then, individual is sentenced. We recently began one of the other recommendations. We have a mental health reentry coordinator now at the jail, and that individual has years of experience in mental health, and he's doing some case planning, again, with a Team MISA focused on individuals who are coming back into the community, making sure that folks transitioning from the jail back onto maybe probation or parole, or in general, simply being released, that they have an opportunity to have a case plan, know what their case who their case manager is, make sure they're provided medication, and then to help make recommendations to keep that person stabilized in the community. Our probation officers as well are very actively engaged. There's a unit there that focuses on individuals with severe mental health diagnoses. But again, that higher rate overall in general in the justice system, where we do see higher rates of substance use disorder specifically, but often this comorbidity, it could be a much higher caseload than maybe what we have the resources for. So we're always looking for ways to improve identification, improve the ability we have to supervise individuals, and it requires this cross-system approach. We would not be able to do it as one agency pitted against another agency. It's extraordinarily important. We have the stakeholders we do engaged as they are, and we really have, I think, good partnerships in Dauphin County to keep this initiative moving forward.
We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Devin Lever, we know from, well, the statistics say and the research says that those who are suffering from a mental illness are even less so than the population overall to be violent. But how do you, as a co-responder, deal with someone who is violent? And I have to remind you, we only have about a minute left.
For me, when it comes in with dealing with somebody is violent, my officers are, one, very protective of me for my own safety because I am not equipped with any safety tools. It's me, myself, and I. So if somebody is becoming very violent, they step in and they come and I try to use verbal judo to help calm them more down. But if they continue to get out of rate, violent, and aggressive, my officers do step in because of safety concerns for myself. They don't want to see me get hurt.
Catherine Kilgore, I know that, and we only have about 30 seconds left, there's a seminar that people can learn more about stepping up?
Sure. Tomorrow, our CJEB's hosting its the Reentry Subcommittee is hosting a Criminal Justice Connect webinar. It's just going to provide a high-level overview on kind of information about our local justice system, some of the initiatives and changes we've made in the past couple years. So I sent a flyer along. Feel free to share it. It's free. It's 12 o'clock to 1:30 tomorrow. We're looking forward to engaging with folks and answering questions as we can.
Catherine Kilgore is Criminal Justice Advisory Board Administrator with Dauphin County District Attorney's Office. Elizabeth Manning, Devin Lever, both co-responders with police. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.